United States versus Palms 20-5072. We are ready when you are, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and my honorable opponent, I'm Blaine Myrie, also in Denver, counsel appointed for Mr. Palms in this appeal. Riley versus California made clear that a warrant is required in order to search a cell phone. And the issue in this case is whether the warrant here was valid or not, whether it satisfied the particularity requirement or not. Our contention is that it did not and that the good faith exception does not apply. I'd like to address the warrant and suppression issue first, and then if there's time remaining, address the Rule 412 evidentiary exclusion issue.
Is it your position that the warrant is insufficient because it didn't refer to the specific statute, criminal statute that was at issue, as opposed to just human trafficking?
Well, it's the lack of specificity with regard to the phrase, the crime of human trafficking. There is no statutory citation either to a state or a federal statute, and this was a state warrant. So some reference to a state statute or a federal statute would have helped with the particularity.
Are you saying it's required? That was my question. Are you saying
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The absence of a statutory site standing alone renders the warrant invalid?
No, because there are other ways to demonstrate particularity. For example, they could have defined human trafficking more specifically. They could have said the crime of human trafficking, specifically engagement in acts of pandering or prostitution or enticement, etc. Something to give it more than just this generic human trafficking. And as we noted, particularly in the reply brief, human trafficking isn't limited to sex trafficking. There is labor trafficking. I believe that some human trafficking could be considered in the drug trade, such as use of drug mules and things like that. So I don't think the phrase the crime of human trafficking is specific enough to satisfy the Fourth Amendment's express particularity requirement.
Obviously, how much can the affidavit provide context for the warrant? I mean, because if you read the affidavit, it's pretty clear we're dealing with prostitution, human trafficking.
Well, the affidavit can provide context for the search conducted under the warrant. And if the affidavit were incorporated into the warrant, then you have something expressed. But there is no language in this warrant that incorporates the affidavit language that is more specific. So this stands or falls on the four corners of the warrant, and the particularity is not satisfied within the four corners of the warrant on the language that is contained therein.
I suppose there are two reasons for a specific warrant. One is to limit the discretion of the officers executing it, and the other is to give notice to the person against whom the warrant is being executed if that person wishes to see the warrant in connection with a search. Now, the latter of those two really, in this particular case, is not material because he didn't ask to see the warrant itself during the search, I understand.
Well, the phone was seized as a search incident to
him. Yeah, I know, but he didn't say, hey, before you come in and take my phone, I want to see and study this warrant.
No, that didn't.
So assuring him about the boundaries of the search is not, at least in this case, something that's relevant. So we really just relate to restricting the conduct of the searching officers. And as to that, they did know the warrant, the affidavit, because the officers executing the search were the same, or at least the primary one was the same as entered the affidavit in the first place.
Yes, Officer Oxford. And I think, Your Honor, that goes really to the question of whether there was good faith here. I still think the particularity requirement isn't fulfilled by the crime of human trafficking. It is not a specific enough restriction within the four corners of the warrant to satisfy the particularity requirement. But it does raise the question, does this then give the officers, I don't want to say sufficient cover, but essentially that's what it is, that the warrant that they executed was in good faith. And we contend that it was not. If you look at first, there's two components to it. The first is the extraction of the phone. And the extraction of the phone was done by an officer, Booth. And he used what's called the Cellebrite system, which is one of these extraction systems that are employed. But he also had access and used two other systems, the Oxygen system and the Sustine system. And he used those in the context of checking to make sure that the full physical extraction was accurate. Now, I'm not a computer expert, so I don't know exactly what that means, but I assume it means that you do a spot check. It's a quality assurance check to make sure that what was extracted was what was meant to be extracted.
But there is no suggestion that quality control check, as you're referring to it, was looked at by anyone at that time in order to evaluate substance of evidence of a crime.
That's correct. But my point in raising that is that in cross-examination, Officer Booth admitted that the extraction from or the oxygen system and the sustained security systems could have been employed to just get the text messages from the phone. They had the capability to do that. And so when the Cellebrite system failed to do what's called the logical or the file extractions, which are narrower than the full physical extractions, our contention is that it was unreasonable then to immediately do the full physical extraction when the officer had on hand the ability to do a narrower extraction of the phone.
There could have been evidence of the crime here, not just in text messages. It could have been in emails. It could have been in pictures, memes. It could have had a file on there dealing with it. So what happened here is they emptied out the contents and then somebody carefully went through, starting, as I understand it, with the text messages and then proceeding and only looking carefully at things that were relevant.
Well, I would take issue with that Officer Oxford went through carefully. Officer Oxford said that, and this is page 124 of the suppression, volume three, which is the suppression hearing, that he looked at everything in the phone other than the cloud data, which I understand was a separate extraction or in a separate extraction report. He used two different methods. He said he went through text messages one by one, as well as doing a search. So it was not simply, a careful search, nor did he document, for example, the time period. He testified that he restricted the time period to a few months, although he could not recall specifically which months, nor did his report document what he restricted those dates to. So there was no documentation done, which I would again submit it shows a lack of carefulness in executing the warrant.
But he said he was restricting, the testimony was he was restricting the warrant to the relevant time period, and he was restricting the warrant to trafficking, sexual trafficking. Didn't he say that those were the two things he was looking, those were the two constraints he was applying?
Those were the two constraints he was applying, and in so doing, because of the breadth of the extraction, he ran across personal stuff that was outside the scope of the warrant.
What did he do?
He said he then moved on, but he didn't stop.
Isn't that what we have said in Loral is exactly what you should do?
I contend first that the extraction should have been narrower, but yes, you should stop and move on, or stop the search entirely at that point and consult the attorney, the U.S. attorneys or a state prosecutor on that.
Did he consult with the U.S. attorney before he started the search?
That I don't recall, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank on whether he did. I know that he consulted when he ran into attorney-client privileged information. I'm not sure if he did before.
Okay. I'm not sure whether he did before either, but I do know that he did some consultations with the U.S. attorney, which is another safeguard that we find comforting in these cases.
And I concede that the cases say that. My concern, though, here is that the extraction was too broad, and because the extraction was too broad, that the sort of universe of evidence they were searching was an unreasonable invasion of Mr. Palm's Fourth Amendment privacy. And as I see my time is winding down, I would like to shift for a couple minutes to the 412 issue. Excuse me. The 412 issue has to do with evidence that came up at a state court preliminary hearing in which M.W. testified that she advertised for sex in 2017, a year before she even met Palms. And the defense sought to introduce this evidence in order to demonstrate that that M.W. knew how to post online ads and to refute the government evidence that it was Mr. Palms who taught her, enticed her into creating these commercial sex ads. At trial, she was asked on cross-examination about her views of commercial sex work, and she testified that it was not something I would choose to do on my own, which arguably is contrary to state preliminary hearing testimony. And at that point, that the next morning, her testimony carried over into the next trial day. Defense counsel asked the court to revisit his 412 ruling and allow the inquiry into the state court preliminary hearing and her testimony that she had engaged in advertising, commercial sex advertising, before she even met Mr. Palms. Our contention, and I'm running short on time and would like some for rebuttal, so I would commend to the court the dissent that Judge Jacobs wrote in the Rivera case, which I think is the most thoughtful analysis of these types of situations. Setting aside whether commercial advertising for sex is falls within the ambit of 412A, it's our contention that that evidence was constitutionally required, both under the Confrontation Clause and order, and as a due process right of Mr. Palms to present evidence in his defense. And if there are no questions on the 412 issue, I would like to reserve the remaining 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That will be fine. Mr. Duncombe, when you're ready.
May it please the court, Thomas Duncombe for the United States. The district court correctly denied the motion to suppress human trafficking evidence found on a device pursuant to a device warrant to search for human trafficking evidence. And the district court correctly prevented the defendant under Rule 412 from asking the victim questions about her prior sex work.
Well, let me start with 412 for a minute. You know, here we have a situation where the witness testified specifically that prostitution is not something she would choose to do on her own. And the evidence that he wanted to put in was directly would show that that was a lie, because she had, well before she met him, engaged in prostitution. I mean, wouldn't it come in for those purposes for a complete defense?
No, Your Honor. First of all, the evidence that the victim provided on cross-examination was not contradictory with the evidence that she testified to in the preliminary hearing, because we don't know the context was of the statement that she provided at the trial about it's not something that I would choose to do on my own. And we don't know what the context was of the posting of ads back in 2017. All they got into at the preliminary hearing was that she posted ads. She said, but I really didn't know what I was doing. And she also said she was put onto it by a former friend. That's pretty obscure. And reading between the lines, one could easily read that as a situation where she felt coerced the first time, or she felt that she didn't really have a choice. Maybe it was because of financial reasons, or maybe it was because she felt coerced. But number one, this was not relevant and probative on a central issue of the case. And number two, even if it was slightly probative of credibility in terms of probing what she meant by that, that would be far outweighed as it was in this court's cases and in the Second Circuit case of Rivera by the prejudice that Rule 412 was designed to prevent. And it's worth noting also that Mr. Palms had an opportunity to cross-examine MW at length, and specifically had an opportunity and did cross-examine MW at length about general credibility, specifically her motive to lie, and also cross-examined the other witnesses about MW's credibility.
Well, I mean, it's a, you know, the evidence in this case is quite close, I think, on whether she was coerced into this later act of a prostitution, or whether she was at least a willing accomplice, although not the initiator of it. So, I mean, when you got kind of a close case, the fact that she may have engaged in prior acts of prostitution voluntarily, it seems to me to be potentially relevant.
I disagree, Your Honor. The case law, both in this circuit and in the Second Circuit with Rivera and the Ninth Circuit with Haynes and the other cases we cited in our brief, could not be more clear that evidence of a sex trafficking victim's prior sex work is not relevant to whether the victim consented to sex work with this particular defendant. If this was a situation where this was a prior relationship with this defendant under Rule 412, that would be in a different posture. But our case law, such as the Willis case, which is not about sex trafficking, but is about consent, the fact that the victim was potentially engaging in sexually assertive behavior or particular sexual behavior is irrelevant. And Rule 412 merely codifies that to the issue of whether the defendant, or excuse me, the victim consented in this case with this defendant.
Is 412 really even applicable when we're talking about posting on the internet? I mean, is that sexual behavior?
If posting an advertisement for sex, if offering sex for sale is not sexual behavior, then offering cocaine for sale is not drug behavior. And second of all, this court has emphasized repeatedly the important bases upon which Rule 412 was enacted. And those bases would be undermined substantially if we narrowly interpreted Rule 12 to only incorporate the actual physical acts of sex. The evidence was designed to show that she was not coerced into sex work. Supposedly, according to Mr. Palms, that was the desire in addition to general credibility. And that was the purpose that the evidence was offered. And again, as this court has said, if the defendant wanted to offer evidence that she had posted online or posted advertisements online, he could have done so. But it was the sexual content of the ads that makes it sexual behavior, because that, when you get down to it, is the actus reus of the crime of prostitution, is offering sex for sale. And it's noteworthy that in this case, Officer Oxford didn't have to wait until MW actually engaged in a sexual act to say, okay, now you're under arrest. All he had to do was wait until she made the offer and he accepted it and they set a term. And that's the sexual behavior, just like coercing someone to engage in sex work is sexual behavior. If I could turn to the court's ruling on the motion to suppress, the warrant here identified with particularity the place to be searched, which was Ramar Palms's phone, and the type of material that the officers could look for, which was human trafficking material.
Counsel, can I just stop you there? Could you respond to opposing counsel's argument that human trafficking is not particular. It's not specified what kind of human trafficking. There's no site. What's your response to that argument?
Well, there's no citation to chapter and verse in the warrant or the warrant affidavit, but in the context of this case, which was a Tulsa police officer seeking a warrant from a state magistrate judge, both parties would have understood that the Oklahoma statute is called human trafficking, and it's 21 Oklahoma statute section 748. And that statute encompasses both sex trafficking and labor trafficking. But again, if you look at the affidavit, it's clear that what Officer Oxford was looking for was the opportunity to search for sex trafficking evidence. And Officer Oxford was the officer who conducted the actual search of the phone. So at very least,
the affidavit was not attached to the warrant.
No, that's correct, Your Honor. And it was not incorporated. And the warrant does have to stand on its face until you get into good faith arguments. But just in terms of the particularity requirement, the warrant here was sufficiently particular when it defined the exact place to be searched, which was a particular phone in evidence, and it defined the types of material, which is what we said was sufficient in Riccardi, and that specific type of material was human trafficking. It's only when you get into the good faith argument.
Did it set a time? I can't recall. Did it set a time frame on the face of the warrant itself?
No, but the affidavit does set forth that those facts and the warrant.
But the warrant, that my question is, does the warrant set forth that time or could it have been unlimited?
No, and that brings it into line with this court's case law in cases such as Christie,
let me talk to you about Christie, because in Christie, although it just said murder, abuse, or I can't remember what the third one, neglect, it said of BW, of a specific person. So to me, that seems like it is particular. You're searching with respect to a specific and sole victim. Here, it's just human trafficking and no restrictions on where you look in the phone and no date restrictions, as Judge Ebell has just pointed out. Is that problematic?
No, because the warrant on its face does identify human trafficking committed by Ramar Palms and any co-conspirators. And that makes sense because the crime of murder, neglect, and abuse of this specific victim, you're unlikely to find evidence on that computer that's going to be relevant to the murder and neglect and abuse of someone else. Whereas there was testimony in this case that pimp culture is such that you may find relevant evidence to this particular act of sex trafficking by force, fraud, or coercion regarding other victims. And it's important to look at text conversations and Cash App conversations regarding other victims and not just MW. That was part and parcel of what they were looking for. Although, again, in the affidavit, when it came time for the officer to determine what it was he was authorized to search, Officer Oxford knew that he was limited by date, that he was limited, he couldn't search the cloud data, which the warrant specifically says. The warrant does exclude cloud data. It says it's going to be retrieved and stored in another place until we get a more specific warrant. And Officer Oxford proceeded with his search he reasonably restricted his search to the types of evidence that would be relevant to the crime of human trafficking and specifically the sex trafficking crime that he was examining. And I want to address something that Mr. Myrie said in questioning by Judge Ebell, which was that they should have stopped the search altogether once they encountered irrelevant material. And if I'm misunderstanding what Mr. Myrie said, then I apologize. But this court's decision in Loera makes it clear that this court, bringing this court into line with the other circuits to have considered the issue, has said that the officers do not have to stop the search entirely once they encounter irrelevant material. The officers can do and should do what they did in this case, which is Once Officer Oxford encountered material that was irrelevant to his search, he stopped reviewing that material and he went back to trying to find evidence of sex trafficking. The additional thing that is noteworthy about this case, although there's no harmless error standard for violations of the Fourth Amendment, if there is a violation, although we have the good faith basis, in the vast majority of the other cases on this issue, there's some other evidence of some other crime that's found, like child pornography in a drug trafficking warrant or child pornography in a computer fraud warrant. Here, the officers were searching for human trafficking evidence and they found human trafficking evidence. There's no evidence. In fact, Officer Oxford was specifically asked, did you find other evidence of other crimes on the phone? And he said, no, I didn't find it.
So, you know, I don't know. We all noticed that in the facts, I'm sure, but I'm befuddled about how much weight to give it. I mean, to say that the search is okay, even though it might have been broad because they didn't find any bad stuff, it's a little bit like saying that a warrantless search of a house is okay because they found incriminating stuff that they were looking for and arrested the bad guy. I mean, we really can't, I think, consider the fruit of the search or the absence of forbidden fruit in a search to validate the search going in, can we?
And I struggled with the weight to give that factor to Judge Ebell, and that's why I tried to bring it up towards the end. The only thing that I think it's relevant to is that it helps illustrate the officer's good faith. Because in terms of searches that this court has seen in the past, despite officers' best intentions and best attempts to keep their searches to relevant evidence only, they still sometimes come across child pornography files or files that are irrelevant to their search. Here, it's noteworthy that Judge Oxford's search parameters, he testified, were narrow. He testified he was being thoughtful about where he was searching. And it seems apparent from what's in the record that he was thoughtful and that he was narrow.
That then leads to this question. Let's say we've got an admittedly excessively broad warrant, but the officer, being a savvy, astute person, says, when I executed that warrant, I exercised some kind of personal limitations on how far I would go because I knew I didn't want to violate things. Can that resuscitate an excessively broad warrant, the fact that additional restraints were voluntarily put on by the officer?
No, Your Honor, the warrant itself still has to be valid. And as you pointed out in the questioning of Mr. Myrie, there are two important purposes here to make sure that the warrant itself is valid or is supported by good faith. And specifically for the facial validity of the warrant, both of the reasons why one would normally be concerned about an overbroad warrant are not implicated in this case. Most notably because Officer Oxford had drafted the very specific, thoughtful affidavit and at no point was attempting, and I see that my time has run out, but may I just finish the answer?
Yes, you can finish your answer.
At no point was Officer Oxford attempting to find any evidence that was outside the scope of this warrant and outside the scope of his affidavit.
Thank you. Mr. Myrie, I think you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Addressing Judge McHugh's inquiry on the 412 issue, I think, Judge, you hit the nail on the head that really the issue here was the ability to present a complete defense with evidence that was probably probatively more strong than any other evidence that Mr. Palms could marshal to show that MW had the ability to post ads, had done them in the past, and therefore was voluntarily engaging it. It's about fundamental fairness and letting the jury decide based on this evidence. And it wasn't a whole bunch of evidence. I mean, it was a question at the state preliminary hearing during that period of time. Have you advertised for sex? Yes.
I have trouble with that. So what, whether she had engaged in acts of prostitution before or not? Even we've always said that the fact that a person is engaged in consensual in sex before isn't evidence that they engaged in it this the new time. And I would think the exact same rule would apply in prostitution. Maybe she was a prostitute before, but that has no bearing on whether she is being coerced this time to be a prostitute.
But as defense counsel noted at trial, one of the issues was that her testimony that is not something she would do voluntarily or not something I would choose to do on my own created the impression that she hadn't and wouldn't have done this on her own, when the state court testimony, if the jury viewed it that way, showed that she in fact did. So
well,
it's,
it did, though. I mean, the problem is it wasn't fleshed out. We don't know whether that earlier testimony was voluntary or not.
Well, correct. And it's my contention is that it's up to the jury to decide that, and it was unconstitutional to exclude the evidence. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take this matter under advisement.